Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Wednesday, May 6th, welcome, 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 friends, on into the program. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Afi Wolfman-Arendt. And today, Cherry, a new podcast and your event.
Yes, the project is called Dying on the Inside, Women Lifers at Muncie Prison. And it focuses on the demographic shift happening inside of America's prisons. If trends continue, in just a few years, a third of incarcerated people will be over the age of 50. But prisons, Avi, were not designed for aging bodies or chronic illness or end-of-life care. So the podcast asks, what happens when a system designed for punishment becomes, in effect, a long-term care facility? And we look at it through the lens of women serving life at Pennsylvania's Muncie Prison. And Avi, I have to mention that I was a reporter for a decade before coming to WHYY, and I stumbled on this issue through my reporting, and it just stuck with me. And 2 years ago, I asked Yvonne Laddie, director of the Logan Center for Urban Investigative Reporting, to partner with me, and with her team, we produced this podcast. And a couple of weeks ago, we launched it at WHYY just after a groundbreaking decision from the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. And we'll hear all about that conversation, that case today on the show. So I would love for you to share your thoughts about aging in prison. We'd love to hear what you think. You can email studio2@whyy.org. Avi, this is a really tough conversation, but I think it's one that we have to have, especially when you're talking about 30, 40 years after our tough on crime years in the 80s and 90s.
I salute you for your reporting and your persistence with this issue, and I'm excited to hear the conversation later this hour. But first, a trio of local news stories, and we start with a very sign of the times story out of Pennsylvania yesterday. Mm-hmm. The Commonwealth announced it's suing an AI chatbot company because it says a company bot misrepresented itself as a licensed doctor. Mm. The company in question is called Character.ai. The lawsuit claims that the chatbot said in a conversation with a state investigator that it was licensed to practice medicine in Pennsylvania, and the bot even provided a fake PA medical license number. The state claims that this is a violation of its Medical Practice Act, which states in part, quote, it shall be unlawful for any person to practice or attempt to offer to practice medicine and surgery without having, at the time of so doing, a valid, unexpired, unrevoked, and unsuspended license. Now, a spokesperson for Character AI said in a statement to the Inquirer, the company does not comment on pending litigation, but then it kind of commented and said it has taken robust steps, including through the display of prominent disclaimers to highlight that user-created characters are, quote, fictional and intended for entertainment and role-playing.
So interesting. I mean, Avi, this technology is so new, and so many people, though, are vulnerable and may actually believe that these chatbots are more than just AI. And according to this lawsuit, when a state investigator started a conversation, they described feeling sad and empty. The bot allegedly mentioned depression. They told them that they were a doctor, and even gave what college they went to in the conversation. So a lot of role playing here. But if you are dealing with mental health issues, you may just believe this.
Yeah. I'm reading over the law again, the Medical Practice Act. It says it shall be unlawful for any person to practice or attempt to offer to practice.
Person. Yeah.
That's exactly what I was going to highlight. So the law says person.
Yeah.
Obviously, the law is written probably pre-AI.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean in this case?
Yeah.
And that's what I'll be following as I imagine this case unfolds. You never know if these things will actually get to trial or not. But it's an important, you know, lawsuit. It feels like it's testing something that we're going to be pushing up against over and over again in the coming years.
Sounds like the law needs to catch up.
Maybe.
Sure.
Maybe.
For sure. We'll see. Story number two, Governor Mikey Sherrill is hoping to make Salem County home to New Jersey's newest nuclear reactor. Governor Sherrill says the state is looking to locate a new reactor at a site near the existing Salem Nuclear Power Plant on the Delaware Bay in Lower Alloways Creek Township, just 13 miles outside of Philadelphia. So this Salem County is pretty close to Philly, by the way. And according to NJ.com, this area is one of six pre-approved national sites that are designated for new nuclear projects. And the governor says that she does not expect any NIMBYism for, that is, you know, local communities from Salem County to push back against this project. This county has a population of about 65,000 residents, and they've been the home of that current nuclear plant, which has operated fairly safely on artificial islands since the late 1970s. So they haven't had any huge issues there. And the governor recently lifted the ban on new nuclear plants in the state, which has opened the door to future projects. Of course, environmental activists have criticized this move, but some Democrats appear to be on board. But, you know, this has been a big issue. Energy demands in New Jersey, affordability was the number one issue in the governor's race. And so
sure was.
She's trying to address it head on.
Feels like nuclear is the elephant in the room when you talk about the future.
You've
of
said
energy.
That repeatedly. We never talk about nuclear.
Yeah,
we never talk about
because it's there.
Yeah.
It works. It doesn't emit carbon, right? Mm-hmm. But it has all these other potential problems. You have to store the waste.
Yeah.
And of course, you have the trauma of Three Mile Island and Chernobyl and the looming possibility of a disaster. And so you just feel like, and the other thing with nuclear is you kind of, it's a heavy upfront investment. Mm-hmm. You can't be like half in on nuclear. It's not like putting up a solar field somewhere. You could say, let's try it out on a smaller, I mean, there's this idea of smaller nuclear, but for the most part, right, you kind of have to pour a lot of money into it. So I'm curious, like, is New Jersey really going to, like, go heavy on nuclear? Because the energy output at the end is significant. Mm-hmm. But it does require a lot of investment and buy-in from a lot of different people.
Yeah, they have a couple of nuclear reactors there. And according to some reporting that I read today, I mean, that together, all together, it does I guess, generate more than about a third of the energy in New Jersey. They're trying to expand
that. Nuclear is
that.
Very powerful.
And so, you know, you got data centers, you got a lot of pulls on the grid. And so they're just trying to figure out some solutions.
Yeah. Story number three, Philadelphia has a new viral television interview star. Thank God. His name is Jamel Ransom. He's a crossing guard in Southwest Philly. He was on the job yesterday when a stolen truck crashed into another vehicle and then careened into a schoolyard. Mm-hmm. Horrible. Thankfully, no children on the playground at the time. Ransom says he actually intervened and rescued a child from one of the vehicles involved in the crash. And then he went on NBC 10 and gave a rather stunning interview, all while wearing his crossing guard cap to the side and licking an ice cream cone.
Okay, you said you saw this.
Yeah.
How did you come to be in that spot?
I'm the crossing guard on 55th and King Session. When I tell you, he ran the light, T-boned the lady, I'm bobbing and weaving. I'm just thankful to be alive right now. Thank you, Jesus.
And it goes on like that for quite some time. He ended this memorable interview by shouting out Mr. Softy, which I guess is how he got the ice cream cone in the first place. Of course, this leads to the logical question. Is this the greatest Philly TV interview of all time? And there's a lot of competition here, Cherry.
Yeah, there is a competition. But I will say this before you go down your list. I've never seen anyone tell such a colorful story while licking an ice cream cone and not letting one drip of ice cream fall off that cone.
He got all the
he
ice cream.
He caught it all. He caught it all.
He paid for that ice cream and he ate that ice cream.
All right. So go ahead. Give me your Mount Rushmore.
Well, these are some of the contenders.
Okay.
So there's the guy on Fox 29 who got so hype over the Phillies that he looked like he was going to explode.
Uh-huh.
Hey, listen to this guy. Tell me how you're feeling here. You're screaming.
I am stoked, baby.
You're screaming like it's still the game going on.
We're talking about the fightings here. The fightings. Said.
Said. Fighting.
Said.
I love it. That was so Philly. That was very Philly.
There was the guy who helped rescue children from a burning building in 2019 and used his 5 minutes of fame to disparage an Eagles wide receiver.
My man just started throwing babies out the window. We was catching them. Unlike Aguilar and his mishaps, I like to put that out there.
He'd like to put that out there. And then there was the guy who saw the sparks from an accident scene in 2017 and thought they were a meteor shower.
Terrible, man. I was in the car smoking a cigarette, and I thought I seen a shooting star. We were far back from the cars, but I thought it was shooting stars going in the air. But here the sign fell down, or they were cutting up or something. I thought it was a bunch of shooting stars. I was making a bunch of wishes.
And I hope those wishes came true, sir.
I do too. And he was smoking a cigarette. Gabe, that's, you got to give detail. Facts. You got to give the details.
I don't know if that is the Mount Rushmore of viral TV interview subjects in Philadelphia. There's some other very good contenders.
But that was a good list.
That's a good
Shout
list.
Out to you.
I had to do that quickly.
Yes.
I am curious if people have other nominees. There was a woman once, it was a very hot day, and the reporter said, ma'am, what are you going to do to keep cool? And she said, look right at him and said, I'm going to wear some booty shorts.
Oh, that would have been so good. That's a good one. We got to pull that one up.
But, I found it. I just didn't have time for it today.
But shout out to you, because I was testing in my mind. I said, I wasn't going to say anything to Avi, but you pulled the guy who...
Unlike Aguilar.
With the baby. I knew that one was going to be
That's your favorite.
List. That's one of my faves.
Yeah, that's a good one. We're very excited to bring you a very important conversation coming up about women aging in a Pennsylvania prison. Stay tuned for that conversation right here on Studio 2 from WHYY.
WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. They're calling it a gray tsunami, and it's headed for prisons across America. By 2030, a third of incarcerated people in this country will be over the age of 50. And while 50 may not be old on the outside, it is geriatric in prison.
We're talking about this topic today, Cherry, because of a new podcast you created with the Logan Center for Urban Investigative Reporting at Temple University. It's called Dying on the Inside, Women Lifers at Muncie Prison. It includes experts and activists on the issue of aging in prison, but also women who are incarcerated in State Correctional Institution Muncie, which is in northern central Pennsylvania.
Yes, and we were extremely limited and who we could talk to and when. But through phone calls, document requests, and research, my team and I went to the prison and gained so much insight into this important issue from the people who are living through it every single day. Take a listen.
This is a prepaid collect call from Sylvia, an incarcerated individual at SCI Muncie.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, Sylvia. This is Cherry. Thank you so much for calling us. I know that...
you're so very welcome.
Yes.
I'm having a pretty rough day today. My back hurting and my feet hurt really bad right now. They're swollen really bad.
Yeah, that sounds like a lot.
Sylvia Boykin is 67 years old. She's serving a life sentence without the possibility of parole at State Correctional Institution Muncie in North Central Pennsylvania. She's been there for 33 years.
I didn't kill anyone or shoot anyone, but I was with somebody who did. And you get the same amount of time as the perpetrator because it's called conspiracy.
She says the man she was with who committed the murder served 6 years. Sylvia now uses a wheelchair and a cane to get around. She is on 12 different medications and spends a lot of time in the prison infirmary. Sylvia is one of over 1,000 people in Pennsylvania serving life without parole for second-degree murder, and many of them who have spent decades behind bars also deal with chronic illness and pain.
A new ruling from the Pennsylvania Supreme Court says that life without parole is unconstitutional for second-degree murder, and it's up to the legislature to now cut through red tape. To talk about all of it, Cherry, you convened a live event here at WHYY with several stakeholders, and that's the bulk of our episode today. On the panel was Noah Barth. He's the Prison Monitoring Director for the Pennsylvania Prison Society, which advocates for the rights of incarcerated people. Also, State Representative Andre Carroll, a Democrat from Germantown, who serves on the House Judiciary Committee.
Yeah, we also hosted Danielle Hadley. She was convicted of first-degree murder in 1990 and sentenced to life without parole. She spent nearly 40 years incarcerated before his sentence was commuted last year at age 61. We were also joined by Rupali Rashitwar. She's an attorney at the Abolitionist Law Center. That's the organization that recently won the case that now outlaws life sentences for second-degree murder in Pennsylvania. Rupali starts us off here by explaining what second-degree murder actually is.
I think the very common example that gets used is someone is the driver of a vehicle. They intended to engage in a burglary. A burglary happened, and there was another person who was the shooter in that case. Under the law in Pennsylvania prior to this case, both the shooter and the person who was the driver would receive the same sentence, which was a life without parole sentence. And so what happened, what the result of this case is it said that the Pennsylvania Constitution affords more rights than the federal constitution under the cruel punishments clause. And so colloquially, you guys might know that the U.S. Constitution says that there's a bar against cruel and unusual punishment. That's the Eighth Amendment that says that's not allowed. Now, the Pennsylvania Constitution says that cruel punishments are not allowed. And so what this ruling says is that for the first time since the Pennsylvania Constitution was in effect, since 1790, that the Pennsylvania Constitution affords more protections. All the people who are serving a sentence of life without parole or death by incarceration for felony murder right now are serving an unconstitutional sentence, and that's more than 1,000 people.
So who does this actually affect? Who would be impacted and who would not be impacted?
So the opinion was very clear that this decision doesn't impact people who are sentenced to first-degree murder. And I think there's an open question of what can happen with this law now that we have this understanding of our state constitution. I'm sure there's going to be other applications. Also, anyone who was sentenced to murder prior to 1974, when we had a different murder statute, could potentially be impacted by this. The most important thing to note, though, is that the Pennsylvania Supreme Court stayed the decision for 120 days.
Yeah.
The legislature has 120 days to figure out what the remedy is going to be, how they're going to deal with 1,000 people who are currently serving this sentence.
So there's a lot of things that are unresolved. And so that's the legal framework that we're dealing with right now. But law on paper and life inside of prison is very different. And so, Danielle, I want to bring you into the conversation because you lived at Muncie for a very long time. Yes. You heard Sylvia's words, what she was talking about. You hear this change that is happening in the law. What resonates with you right now?
Up until June of last year, I was living the same way that she was living, in pain, and not a lot of help from staff. But because of the time that I've spent there, I have family there. So as far as being able to get to appointments and things like that and just making sure that I was okay on a daily basis.
Yeah. You spent nearly 4 decades in prison. What toll did it take on you physically and emotionally to spend that much time in prison?
Well, as you can see, physically I am disabled because of the lack of medical care. They don't do preventative medication. They wait until it's the last alternative before they do what they need to do to help you. So because they waited so long, I've had 4 back surgeries.
Danielle, I mean, you have always said that you felt that you should do time. I want you to try to help us understand accountability and how you see it now.
At 23, I didn't have an appreciation for anyone's life, not even my own. But growing into the woman that I become, I can see how precious life is and what it means not just to me, but to my family members. So if it means that much to me and my family members, I can only imagine what it means to the victims of people who were hurt through some type of crime. I lived with that for a long time, not understanding what they may have felt. When I think about back to who I was then, sometimes I don't know who she was. But I do know I appreciate it now, and I'm thankful for it.
Thank you for that. I want to bring you into the conversation, Representative Carroll. You hear what Danielle had to say. We hear where the law currently stands, and you're on the Judiciary Committee where lawmakers are wrestling with these issues right now. We're wrestling with the issues of accountability, justice for victims. Danielle talked about she understands, and it took her a while to understand that, but she understands now. What does holding all those truths and balancing all those truths look like when you're trying to make big decisions about next steps and could impact hundreds and hundreds of lives here in Pennsylvania?
Yeah, thank you for that. First and foremost, I want to say welcome home, Danielle, and thank you so much for sharing your story and being a voice for folks who are on the other side of the wall. I want to thank you, Cherry, for bringing this conversation. Thank you for that.
Absolutely.
I am also, too, want to center my comments on the fact that before I ever ran for office, you know, I was an organizer. I don't hold a law degree, and I think that being in the state ledge as an organizer and a person who operates from lived experience is very unique. It adds value to the conversation. Most of my colleagues who sit on the Judiciary Committee and argue these arguments, they're arguing from a legal standpoint. And what I try to do my best is listen to people who's been impacted by the issues and use their stories as a way to make laws. And it's those stories that really deeply inform my commitment to making sure that the votes that I cast are in line with the reality of folks who are living on the other side of the walls. I'll mention that in this unique opportunity, because what we're seeing right now is not the usual, right? We're seeing a Supreme Court in this Commonwealth say publicly and on paper that the sentencing that's been given to 5,000 people across the state is unconstitutional, 1,200 of whom fall underneath of this felony murder statute. So it's challenging the conscience of us, but also challenging us to restructure some of the guidelines that people's life has been impacted by.
Yeah, and when you think about it, I mean, in your mind, what does public safety look like when we're talking about people who are older and people who are seriously ill? And I'll mention this story, and you'll hear about it in the podcast, but Yvonne Laddie and I, we actually met a woman who was incarcerated who had deep dementia, did not know where she was, who she was, what day it was, and here she is behind bars. And so I wonder when you think about what public safety looks like, balancing some of those many considerations, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a few takes on this. So recently, I guess, introduced a bill that would reduce the age for expungement. And right now, currently in state of Pennsylvania for low-level crimes, the age is 70. So a person has not only be beyond the retirement age, they have to age 5 more years before the state would allow you to petition the courts to then get an expungement for low-level crimes. Like, these are not crimes that has resulted even in a death. But the other thing, too, is that we have to attack this issue on another level, because compassionate release is also not on the books here in Pennsylvania. So a person like Danielle, who is aging in prison and experiencing medical needs, we would allow them to, unfortunately, die in prison. And when people do time, it's not just the individual, it's also their families. So when a person is been in jail for 40 years, I imagine how old is the mother, the father, and the siblings. You know, there's a young man right now that I've been talking to, and his parents are aging. Like, they're aging. They're seniors. And they can't travel 3.5 hours to visit their own child. But when I talk to, unfortunately, the Department of Corrections, and I make the case of, like, we need to move this person closer to home, that's not a qualifying excuse right now to get people closer to their family.
A lot of things to think about.
Exactly.
Representative Carroll, thank you for that. Noah, I want to bring you into the conversation. Widen the lens. I mean, we heard what Rep. Carroll said. We heard Danielle's experience and your work visiting prisons across the Commonwealth. How typical is some of the things we heard Danielle talk about in your visits and in your conversations with men and women in the system?
Yeah, it's unfortunately common. We have over 2,000 people serving life sentences who are over the age of 55 in our state. And I say 55 because that's typically what's considered geriatric for prison, because of the aging impact just being in prison has on you, the rate at which it accelerates decline in the human body. Just a couple weeks ago, I was at SCI Phoenix. It's our largest state prison, just an hour north of the city. And one of the people I met with there has been inside for 52 years. He's done 52 years. He's in a wheelchair. He's diabetic. He now has stage 3 liver cancer. And he's been waiting over 6 months to get an eye exam because he's having vision issues in one of his eyes. The logic of that situation, it evades me. There's certainly no public safety reason that gentleman should still be in prison.
And let me follow up with you, Noah. I mean, what are prisons required to do? Do they have to make sure that you have the eye exam as soon as you experience eye problems? Or is there a window where it's not neglect, you know, just give us the standard of care and then where those gaps exist.
I mean, that's the million-dollar question, right? If you look at it in spirit, the prisons writ large are responsible for the safety, health, and well-being of the people in their custody, full stop, right? The court system, the larger criminal justice system, has removed them from their home and community and said, here's where you're going to live, and we control every aspect of your life. To me, that makes it very clear. I mean, for starters, they should be giving them enough food. Every person I talk to says they don't get fed enough consistently. County jail, state prison. That's a regular complaint. And so they're forced to buy commissary, right? They're forced to buy enough food. Basic medical care should be there, but mammograms don't happen, colonoscopies, pap smears, regular routine things that we think, you know, are basics don't happen. It's not to say that it's completely derelict, but the number one complaint we consistently receive at our organization is related to medical care. Delays, denial, or inappropriate care. You know, and I should say this also. I've met a number of correctional officers and administrators who are trying to do the right thing, right? I don't want to paint this like there's nobody out there who cares and isn't doing their job. But, you know, it's people's lives.
That was Noah Barth, Prison Monitoring Director for the Pennsylvania Prison Society. If you're just joining us, we're listening to a recent panel discussion about aging in prison and what that means for incarcerated people, their families, and institutions that may not be equipped to handle the host of issues that arise among a technically geriatric prison population. It's all tied to a new podcast that Cherry is co-EP and host of alongside Temple University's Logan Center for Urban Investigative Reporting. It's called Dying on the Inside, Women Lifers at Muncie Prison.
We also heard from Danielle Hadley, who was incarcerated for nearly 40 years, and from Rupali Rashatwar from the Abolitionist Law Center and State Representative Andre Carroll. In the beginning of our panel, I asked people to raise their hand if they've thought a lot about this issue, and not many people did. It's hard for us on the outside to imagine what prison is like, let alone what it's like for older people. But one thing most people are aware of is the extremely high cost of corrections in this country.
This is expensive when you talk about providing high-level care to large numbers of people who are geriatric.
We have two state prisons that are former hospitals. The average annual cost of keeping someone at SCI Laurel Highlands is over $100,000 a year that we're paying to keep these folks who, frankly, should be home, right? DOC just opened a second dialysis unit at another prison because there's that many people who need kidney dialysis in the system. They recently, a couple years ago, opened a special unit for neurodivergent individuals, which is wonderful. But now there's a wait list to even get in it because there are so many people that are neurodivergent that we're locking up in prison. They're not equipped to meet their needs. The other thing, though, is, you know, we can look at the budget, right? I believe it's $3.4 billion with a B that we spend on the Department of Corrections. That doesn't include county jails, right? That's just the state prison system. But there's also the cost to the community. We as a society spend untold dollars on prisons. You know, when you disrupt families and communities, when you take wage earners out of their community, right, that has a downstream impact to their families and the people they live around. But it's also very expensive to have a loved one in prison. You know, I mentioned commissary. It is not unusual for people to spend the full $100 a month limit on commissary. The cost it takes to get out, to travel, to visit loved ones, to put money for their phone time. If you need to see a medical professional inside of a state prison, there's a $5 copay.
Yeah.
You might say, okay, $5, but the average salaries are 23 to 42 cents an hour. So, you know, you do the math and it's a barrier to care. And it means you got to have someone on the outside who's maybe making some other choices with their budget in order to make sure you're taken care of. It can be expensive. It can be stressful. Financial stress adds all kinds of problems to people's lives. Yeah. I think we all know that these days. It's very expensive.
And that's a whole ripple effect. I want to bring you back into the conversation, Rupali, because there are pathways to getting out. And Rep. Carroll kind of like foreshadowed that. And I'm thinking, you know, compassionate release. I'm thinking opportunities through commutation, which Danielle was able to experience. How easy or hard is it to access? I mean, especially when you're dealing with all the things that Noah just talked about, you have access to funding and lawyers and all those things.
Yeah, I mean, I think the reason why this conversation is so important is because when we're talking about people who are serving these death by incarceration sentences, life without parole sentences, There is no other way to petition for relief other than through the commutation process, which is when you get the governor to grant clemency, and for someone who's serving a life sentence, that's commuting your sentence to parole, or through getting compassionate release. And the reality is both of those avenues are so difficult to navigate. You know, I would just push back slightly. I think, Representative Carroll, you're talking about compassionate release in the state. Our firm has done maybe 20 cases, so I can talk a lot about what it looks like, and it is the furthest thing from compassionate.
Break it down.
Yeah. The law as it's drafted requires that individuals in prison be within 1 year of dying, that their treating physicians say that. And it doesn't entitle people to counsel, and it doesn't necessarily require the DOC to help at all with doing any planning to get someone connected to a nursing facility to get them any kind of care in the community. And so, in effect, you know, this law has been on the books since 2009. Maybe only about 70 people have been able to access relief under the law because it's so narrowly drafted, and a lot of people aren't given a death date like that. We would just hear a very, very common refrain that people would be complaining for so many years about some symptom to the prison infirmary. They wouldn't get checked out. And by the time it got checked out, they would find out that the headache they had was now stage 4 cancer. We've represented a lot of people under those kinds of circumstances where it's bittersweet. You're able to access some relief, but by that point, you're so sick and people pass away before they can get to court.
Yeah.
And what I'll say about commutation is that it is a very difficult and political process. From the time you apply, now it's 3 to 5 years until your application gets processed. It requires enough votes at a merit stage to then get to a public hearing, and then it requires a unanimous vote. And part of the board, of the 5 people who are on our board of pardons, 2 of them are politically elected, which makes it a very political process. A reality is that a lot of politicians are afraid of acknowledging the realities that aging people need to be out of prison. They're afraid that something might happen. And so there's been so many people who should be able to get relief through that process who haven't been able to access it. So it's political. It's not transparent. It's very difficult.
Yeah. And Danielle, you were able to go through the process. What was it like for you?
This was the 3rd time applying. The first time was in 2009. The second time was in 2016, and the 3rd time was in 2021.
And so this, when you,
this time
you got out in 2025, right. Last year in June.
Right.
That was from your 2021 application?
Yes.
Wow.
It takes anywhere from, like she said, from 3 to 5 years.
And what do you think made the difference this 3rd time?
The Lord. That's it. That's it, because there are so many other people like myself who worked hard and who spent decade after decade, women much older than myself, who are suffering, excuse me, who deserve it just as much, and if not more than I do. It had to be the hand of God. And also, I think my mom as well. She fought for me every single day, and she passed away 12 days before I would. What's commuted?
I'm sorry for your loss. By the way, Danielle is very blessed because you have so many family members who have supported you, your children.
Yes, my children, my aunt, my cousins.
Yeah.
My cousins, my aunts, uncles. And that makes a difference, too. It makes all the difference in the world on how you're treated in the prison as well, too, because my family was not going to sit by and allow them just to treat me any type of way. If they know that you have somebody supporting you who's willing to call, who's willing to drive up there, then they're going to do a little bit more than they would do for the next person.
Yeah, you have people advocating for you. Representative Carroll, I was on a call the Abolitionist Law Center, FAM, a lot of advocates were talking about this idea of 25 years. And how many years people would have to do before they could even be considered, right, for parole. So what are some of the sticking points? What are you hearing? What have been the reasons why people have sort of been stalling on this topic and won't push it forward? What are the big issues?
There's a few points of contention, right? One of the things is I have made a public commitment and I will not vote for a mandatory minimum. Mm-hmm. That is just not the way I believe that we should apply justice. The other thing, too, is that right now, when we talk about culpability, one of the other factors that a lot of my colleagues believe that we should be able to do is evaluate people on their progress. If a person's been in jail for 4 decades, if a person's been in jail for 1 decade, that is enough time for us to say, what is the progress that this individual has made? And we should be judging them according to that. And as Danielle spoke about, a lot of the times we judge people on the basis of the crime that they're accused of and on a rap sheet, literally looking at a paper. We have to humanize people. The other thing for me and a couple of my other colleagues is retroactivity, making sure that whenever we get this bill on the books, which I'm hopeful that we will get done and we do our jobs and don't send it back to the courts, is that we're making sure that we retroact this law, that everyone will be available that's currently under the felony murder statute.
And so there's a lot of talking points. Yeah. 120 days. Do you think you're going to make it?
I'm hopeful.
That was State Representative Andre Carroll, a Democrat from Germantown, serving on the House Judiciary Committee. The legislature has until July 25th to sort out the logistics of a recent Pennsylvania Supreme Court ruling that makes life sentencing without parole unconstitutional in the Commonwealth.
Yes, we also heard from the Abolitionist Law Center's Rupali Rachitwar, Noah Barth of the Pennsylvania Prison Society, and Danielle Hadley, whose sentence was commuted last year after serving 4 decades for first-degree murder.
A lot packed into this conversation so far, Cherry, but most urgent seems like that 120-day deadline in the legislature.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of debate over who this ruling should apply to, accountability for the people convicted of these crimes, potential retroactivity, and changes to mandatory minimums.
In just a moment, we'll be back with more of Cherry's panel discussion, including a look at how many COVID-era prison policies have remained in effect to the detriment of incarcerated people. We'll be right back.
WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives. One moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We're listening this hour to an event that Cherry recently hosted at WHYY to launch her new podcast with the Logan Center for Investigative Journalism at Temple University. It's called Dying on the Inside, Women Lifers at Muncie Prison. It's based on Cherry's reporting on a state prison in northern central Pennsylvania.
Yeah, it's a nuanced subject with valid points of view on many sides, including for victims and their families. And as I got to know the women serving life sentences, I addressed the issue of accountability with them head on. And to me, the larger question of the podcast became, where does the line between accountability and justice end and cruelty begin? I interviewed Christina Reyes. Her stepfather, uncle, and cousin were all victims of murder. She forgave their killers, but understands how hard it is to forgive. Take a listen.
With my father, when he was murdered with my uncle, there was nobody ever charged. And I know the feeling of, like, you don't have someone to, like, put that anger towards, right? So I feel like everybody is holding their emotions differently and their grief differently, and also like how they move forward differently.
Really important part of the show today. Let's get back now to the discussion with State Representative Andre Carroll of Germantown, Noah Barth of the Pennsylvania Prison Society, and Danielle Hadley, who spent nearly 40 years in prison on a first-degree murder charge. Her sentence was commuted last year.
We also have attorney Rupali Rachitwar from the Abolitionist Law Center. We mentioned earlier that a recent court decision made life sentences for second-degree murder unconstitutional in Pennsylvania. Lawmakers have to figure out now how to apply the new ruling by late July. Rupali picks us back up here explaining what would happen if the legislature can't find agreement before that deadline.
So essentially what would happen is the court would have to weigh in on the question of retroactivity. Likely through another case that would come up, the court would have to determine whether or not the relief that they're giving to Derek Lee, they would look back and give to others. For the 1,000 plus people serving that sentence, they would have to file something in the courts, and the court would have to answer all those questions. I think a lot of people are prepared for that possibility and talking about what it would look like from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, but it would have to get resolved by the courts.
Yeah. Noah, I wonder, like, you've been in the prisons, you've seen what people are living with. I know Rep. Carroll is hopeful, but Rupali talked about what the result could be, and Danielle has experienced it herself. And so what are some things, some reforms that could happen, like realistically, to sort of make sure people make it if they have to wait?
Could happen or should happen?
You can give me some coulds and some shoulds.
I'm going to start with the shoulds because that's a little easier. I mean, first off, this is a huge development. It's really exciting. I believe, and I think a lot of people in this room probably believe, there shouldn't be a such thing as life without parole for anyone, full stop. The very idea that we're going to warehouse someone until the end of their life and say, you have no chance of redemption, you have no place in society anymore, I think that's deeply problematic. So, you know, maybe it's one step at a time, but, you know, to my colleague right next to me right here, that's the next hurdle. But in terms of what can help people get through, you know, I think part of it, at the beginning, you asked for a show of hands, you know, how many people have thought deeply about what it's like to be elderly in a prison, right? And you're saying you hadn't thought about it. I think part of the thing with prisons is they're so closed off. They're so out of sight, out of mind for so many people that we fail to realize they're complete societies. They're complete ecosystems, right? There's spiritual development. There's love. There's family. There's work and vocation. That, you know, all these aspects of our daily lives that we think about, those are questions to be answered in a prison context too. And prisons are not designed for humans, right? They're designed for security, for closing down, and not these things. It's getting people through. I mean, for starters, more programming availability to everyone, not only people pre-release, right? We know that on the outside, we know the value of education isn't just to the individual, but to their community. Activities and other programming should be broadly available. Better healthcare, more readily available. There's a shortage of nurses. It's a problem. I don't know how you fix that one, honestly, but yeah, it needs to be fixed, period. More access to basic due process. You know, the grievance system, the internal mechanisms within the prison, the idea that people have to fight tooth and nail for basic healthcare and things, you know, family visits. Since COVID, there have been severe restrictions on family visiting inside of state prisons. And we know that has a major impact on people's psychic, emotional well-being, right? Yeah. Family connection to loved ones, being able to see your children. 2020 was a crazy year, and we had to change our routine a little bit. But at this point, there's no justification for it in my mind. Muncie is actually the one exception of state prisons, interestingly. In all the rest of them, the dining halls are closed, and you have to eat your meals in your cell. You know, think about that. That's, you know, a room maybe a third the size of this stage with another human being in a toilet. And that's where you eat your meals, right? The lack of dignity, the lack of opportunity for community and sharing a meal that's so fundamental. That's something they could do tomorrow if they really wanted to. They could open those dining halls back up.
So there are some low-hanging fruit there.
There's a lot of it.
That could be done. Yeah. I wanted to sort of end, you know, on a note of where we can talk to this audience. A lot of these folks here may not have known about this issue, may not have given it deep thought. There's probably a lot of people in community that when they hear about it, and anytime we brought this up, people would be like, huh, they had literally not given this issue a thought. And so what is one thing you want this audience or people who hear this podcast or learn about this issue, what do you want them to understand about aging in prison or long-term incarceration that they might not have understood before? And Noah, we'll go to you, Rupali, Rep. Carroll, and we'll end with Danielle.
That's a big question. The first thing that occurs to me is, you know, if people listening to this podcast, if this strikes them, it strikes a chord for them and they're thinking about it and they're worried about it, which is great. I just want to remind them that, you know, the experience of older individuals inside of prison, that's sort of the leading edge of this. Right? These are people who physically and or mentally, depending on how they're aging, may have exceptionally hard time with the realities of prison, but everyone does. We need to change the situation for our elders, but I think we need to change it for all our neighbors inside of prison. And this hopefully is a window to think about all these other bigger questions and issues with how we handle criminal justice in this country and in this state, because it doesn't have to be this way. It is a choice.
Yeah. And Polly?
I would add to that, dying in a cage is cruel. And after seeing and hearing about so many people who are trying to get care and struggling with it, I can definitively say every release mechanism that exists now for so many people serving these life sentences, I mean, they're inadequate. They're not working. We need meaningful pathways to release, and we need more people, I think, to be talking about this, putting pressure on legislators to actually do something about this and really create change, because honestly, we can fight for change in the judiciary, but what we really need is massive policy change to get a lot of people out.
And I want, Rep. Carroll, before we give it to Danielle to close it out, I want you to give your one thing. But I also know that victims, you know, we didn't go into detail here about victims and how and their feelings about this, but you as an elected person have to hear from all of that. You have to consider all of that. So what is the one thing you want people to know on all sides of the aisle as you think about this issue? And you go back to the negotiation table with the House Judiciary Committee.
Yeah. So, you know, I live in my community. I have the same house which my grandmother raised me in is a house that I own now. I live in the same block that I played on as a kid. The same gunshots that my neighbor hear, I hear the same gunshots. I recognize that we have threats of dangers in our community. The thing that I also recognize that I'm no safer because someone died in jail. What we have to recognize is that true justice is not punishing one to death. True justice is rehabilitation. And a part of rehabilitation is an assessment of that person. You can't assess a dead person. So in this moment for me, you know, I've been in Muncie several times. And when I ran for office the first time in 2022, I had a campaign manager, Steph, who had an aunt who's currently still located at Muncie. And this woman has been at Muncie for over 30 years. And I've had a chance to know her story, listen to her hopes, her dreams, and to recognize that she's a completely different person today than she was when the crime was committed. We must give people opportunities. We are not just allowing people to die, but we're also hurting ourselves. We mentioned how much we're spending on incarceration. In an affordability crisis right now, there's so many other things we can be spending our money on.
Thank you for that. And before we open up the questions, Danielle, I want to tell people what is one thing that you hope folks who may not have looked at this issue, people in this audience who may not have heard about this, what is one thing you hope that they take away?
That people change. 30, 40 years, nobody's the same as they was at that time, inside or out. So just a second chance. Give people a chance.
Thank you very much for that. I want to open it up to questions. And if you have a question, you hold your hand up. And you do? Okay.
My name is Joyce. They call me Star. My question is compassionate release. The last time I checked, the person, when they get released, once they get fixed, they must go back to prison.
I can weigh in on that. Technically, the law says that if there's a material change in their condition, then they could have to go back. So if someone was to be miraculously cured of their terminal illness, that could happen. But I'm aware of people who've lived 2 years after coming home and they didn't have to go back. So there's not a requirement that someone go back if they live longer. But that is an unfair thing that is written into the rule. Again, a reason why we need a new law.
Hi, my name is Minae, and I, too, am a former inmate at Muncie. I met Danielle there, and she took me in, welcomed me in, and from there, we have been together. I've been home for 10 years. So, I know that Muncie, yes, is prison, but I do firsthand know that, Danielle, you have accumulated so many certificates, degrees, and so many things under your belt from SEI Muncie. Well, now that you are home, I want to know how you are going to utilize all of the skills that you have obtained and how you plan to use that back and give back to the community.
At the moment, I'm just struggling to get my health in order so that I can pursue some type of employment. I've taken a course in phlebotomy. I'm actually taking my certification test tomorrow.
Oh, good luck, good luck, good luck.
So I'm on the slow road to gainful employment.
And that was Danielle Hadley, a Philadelphia woman who was convicted of first-degree murder in 1990 and sentenced to life without parole. She spent nearly 40 years incarcerated before her sentence was commuted last year at age 61. Thanks to our other panelists, Rupali Rachitwar of the Abolitionist Law Center, Noah Barth of the Pennsylvania Prison Society, and Andre Carroll, a Democrat who represents Germantown in the State House. And I had a lot of people to thank for the dedication to this issue. And I got to say thank you to Yvonne Laddie, Colin Evans, Natalie Wright, and the entire team at Temple University's Logan Center for Urban Investigative Reporting. Thanks to WHYY's Joan Isabella and Yvette Sizer, and to everyone who was willing to lend their voice to this podcast, especially the women lifers at Muncie. To open yourself up to strangers takes courage and vulnerability, and I truly hope we did them justice. And I have to do a quick plug because Dying on the Inside, Women Lifers at Muncie Prison, is available right now wherever you get your podcast. Episode 3 about hospice in prison came out today. Please listen, rate, and review, and share.
And speaking of hospice, Marie from Sellersville writes us and says, I'm a hospice nurse. We sometimes get dying patients who must be shackled to a bed or are not allowed visitation at the end of their life. It is so difficult. Marta says we must urge the passage of HB 443 ASAP. And an anonymous emailer wrote in to say, bravo, Cherry Gregg, and bravo to our state Supreme Court for this finding. I urge all listeners to call their state senator and state representative to support this change for less cruelty in our state prison system.
Yeah.
And let me thank our producers today on Studio 2, Debbie Builder, Hazel Mae Bryan, and Paige Marie Bessler. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. Al Banks engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory. From Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Thank you so much for joining us today.